Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. In fact, this is our 100th edition of the program since we started back in the fall of 2007, and it's my great privilege to have with me on the show today Art Stephenson of Easton, who's got a very interesting story to tell. Pretty remarkable for a young man to spend 3 years in the infantry in Europe and come back without any major scratches or maybe a few bumps and bruises. We'll get the story from Art himself. And I learned something new about Art today. He and I share the same birthday, October 19th, but his was a little earlier than mine. He'll be 90 later this year, and he's going to be busy between now and that October birthday. And Art, you were busy back during World War II. I'd like to start with you the way I start with every veteran and ask about December 7th, 1941. You had already graduated from high school a couple years before that, a Washington Union Panther, class of 38. What were you doing in December of 1941, and how did you hear about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
At that time, I was office manager for Central Valley Cement because I was in the accounting field. Mm-hmm. And we were on our way home from church and heard on the car radio that had bombed Pearl Harbor, and we weren't really familiar with Pearl Harbor, of course. But so that was the beginning of
And you learned about it pretty quickly.
Very quickly, yes. Yeah.
Now, and I understand you had the idea that that volunteering for the Signal Corps might be a good way to serve in World War II.
Yes, that's right.
How did that work out for
you?
Well,
they were full of people. They wanted to train people. I was not training any specific deal, but I wasn't a specific occupation, so they told me to wait, and in the meantime, I was drafted and into the infantry.
At that time, was that something that was a big shock to you or really jarring? Was it a disappointment, or you just kind of accepted as well?
No,
this is the way it's got to be.
I was expecting it. I knew it would be coming. I was already married, and, of course, I was out for a year. I was out on a 3A classification. I knew eventually that they would be drafting me into the service.
You know, most of the guys that I talked to met their brides either during or after the war. Yeah. Not too many guys that got married before the war, and it's always been very fascinating to me to try to understand how you reconcile that. How do you deal that with in your mind when you've got this, you know, fairly new bride that you're leaving behind, and you don't know if you're coming back.
That's very true. It's you wonder, you know. What can you do? There's nothing much you can do. Just wait for your orders and see what happens on the thing.
I imagine that was probably a tearful goodbye when you left.
Oh, yes, certainly so. Yes. Yeah.
Did you two send letters back and forth?
Oh yes, we sent letters back and forth. Yes. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, of course, the mail didn't reach us up on the front until it was pretty cold on the thing. On the old mail.
The mail froze.
Yeah.
A lot of things froze at the Battle of the Bulge, which, for those who don't know, was still raging at this time 65 years ago on the European continent, the coldest winter on record there. Art was there, but before you got there, you had some other things to do with your unit. You ended up in the 75th Infantry Division, the 289th Regiment, the 3rd Battalion. What was kind of your welcome to the Army experience? When did you realize this is what it's going to be like with these guys?
Well, right away, I was shipped to the Presidio of Monterey and spent 5 days there and put on a train for Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, where we activated the 75th Infantry Division. And arrived at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they were playing "This is the Army, Mr. Jones," and we knew that life was going to change for us at that time.
You were a little older, I suppose, than a lot of the guys going with you there. There were probably a lot of 18-year-olds,
yes,
I imagine.
I was one of the older men in the platoon. I was 20 years old, of course, at the time. So.
Did you feel like maybe it was an easier adjustment for you, that you had been through a little more than they had?
Well, I think I had a little more responsibility, having already been married and was married, and the others were more or less carefree and more or less, what do you say, gung-ho sort of thing. I was more conservative.
Did you think that, I mean, everybody obviously wants to come back from the war, but did you think maybe it gave you a greater reason or a more significant reason to survive, knowing that you had your wife waiting for you at home?
Oh, sure. I was thinking that I was, you know, had big plans before Pearl Harbor, but they had changed immediately.
And it's kind of hard to make any plans when the war is. You don't know how long the war. Nothing That's tells you in 1945 this is all going to be over.
Yeah, we thought so. Yeah, of course you were in for the war of the duration. That was it. I think we didn't know what the duration would be at the time. So,
as an infantryman, what did you expect that your duties would be, and what kind of training did you get for that?
We had excellent training at Fort Leonard Wood. Of course, we learned various weapons, but our main weapon was the M1 rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And we had supporting weapons in the company, the mortar and so on. But mostly our training involved in squad tactics and with actual infantry men and things. We could call in artillery, but artillery was always in the background.
Now, you talk about that M1, and a thought just popped into my mind. I know you've stayed very active throughout your life, and you love to play tennis and everything. If you were out at your raisin vineyard and you saw a gopher popping up at 100 yards away, you think you could take him out with that M1?
I could at that time. I didn't wear glasses then, but I think I – well, I'm sure I could, yeah.
I believe it. I take your word for it. Well, and with all that training, and you just described it as very good, very strong training that you received, I imagine nothing really prepared you completely for what you would face once you got overseas. Tell me what you remember about heading over, the kind of things that are going through your mind, and what you expected when you. That's I imagine that journey across the Atlantic seems to take longer than it really does.
The Atlantic was rough, and we went over on an English ship, which in the food wasn't the best. And we were wondering when actually how long would we be landing before we went into combat. We were supposedly combat ready, although you're never really that ready, I think. But we did land in England and had some more training before we hit the beach of France.
And when you got to France, how long after D-Day was that?
We were forced to not go in. Didn't go in until about October. Mm-hmm. We came in through Le Havre down there, and the port was already secure.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have any action landing on the thing.
Which I know you're thankful for, but yeah, so. you guys would make up for it in a hurry there with the 75th Infantry Division. What was your first taste of combat, and was it something that you expected, that it was the way you anticipated it would be, or did it really kind of blow your mind and take your breath away?
It was we hit on the 20th or 22nd of December. We were moving up to attack the village of Grand Manille, and on the road at night, and the tanks were coming down. There was the first silhouette. There was a Sherman, must be friendly tanks. However, we didn't know it was driven by, it had been captured by the Germans, and back at a distance was followed by six or seven German Panzer tanks. Well, the outpost had let them on through, and we couldn't see too much. And of course, the minute they get through us, they turn and ambush us. So we got off the road and got up onto a hill to dig in. And that night they called in artillery and repulsed them, and finally the Germans had to retreat.
So this is your first taste of combat, and the first thing you see is an American tank that ends up firing at you.
Yeah, that's right. Quite confusing.
Oh, I can't imagine what that does to you. I mean, it has to tell you, well, we can't count on anything now.
That's right.
And it wasn't exactly resort-style weather either.
It was dark, and it was around, as I recall at the time, it was around 12 to 14 below zero.
So this is just before Christmas in 1944.
Right, yes.
The first week of the Battle of the Bulge is underway. What are you doing to stay warm at night? Because you're an infantryman. You don't have the deluxe accommodations at the chateau.
Unfortunately, our winter garb didn't really reach us clear till February. We were in fall-type clothes with field jackets and just ordinary combat boots. And, of course, what you do, you dig your foxhole and
if the ground is soft enough.
That's right.
How far could you dig?
Well, you dig down maybe to 4 or 5 feet, but the problem there was then after the warmth then the moisture would ooze in, you'd have mud in the thing there. Mm-hmm. But you, if you were fortunate you had to have young trees or pine boughs, you'd try to put them down, line them, and if you had the tools, you would cut enough small saplings to put a roof on the top and probably put your raincoat on top to, for a little shelter on the thing. But you couldn't have any fires, naturally. It was just depending on body heat and the thing.
Yeah, if you had a fire, the Germans know where you are.
Yeah, sure, yes. Yeah, sure.
And that'll be the last fire you ever make.
That's right.
Well, the time is right along here, and we need to take our first commercial break. But when we come back, we'll talk about more than just the first day of two, a day or two for Art Stephenson at the Battle of the Bulge and his time in the service during World War II. Tell you what he's done since then to commemorate the Battle of the Bulge, how he's involved here locally, and hear more of his experiences as a U.S. Army infantryman in World War II. Art Stephenson, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
We roll along with Hometown Heroes on this Saturday. My guest today, Art Stephenson. And by that music, you should know that he is an Army veteran of World War II, having served in the 75th Infantry Division in Europe, more specifically the 289th Regiment, the 3rd Battalion. He's originally from Easton, where he graduated from Washington Union High School way back in 1938. He'll turn 90 years old later this year, but clearly his memory is still sharp. You heard before the break him describe his events early on in the service, that early taste of combat, where the first thing he saw was an American tank that had been captured by the Germans shooting at his folks, which was certainly jarring. The weather was pretty bad, too. That was the Battle of the Bulge, that coldest winter that Europe had ever experienced. And 65 years ago today, that Battle of the Bulge was still taking place. Art has been very involved over the years, in fact, for more than 40 years, with the veterans of the Battle of the Bulge organization. In fact, he's a longtime officer in that group here locally. And if you are a local veteran who was at the Battle of the Bulge and you're not part of that group, the Battle of the Bulge survivors, the veterans of the Battle of the Bulge organization, send me an email at paul@kmjnow.com or give me a call here at the radio station, and I will put you in touch with Art and his group. You might enjoy catching up and trading some stories with local veterans who are at the Battle of the Bulge. So, not to make you cold, Art, but let's take you back there to the Battle of the Bulge. You talked about what it took just to make a foxhole there, which was certainly no easy feat. And speaking of feet, how long before your feet got frozen? Because I don't think I've talked to a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge yet who didn't have some kind of experience with frozen feet.
It didn't. Yeah, we were. I would say that the lack of the winter equipment that probably after a month's time, your feet started getting numb because there was no way to dry, and they were wet a lot of the time, and no way of drying them out, and they just stayed sort of numb for the entire duration of the, in my case, for the entire duration of the bulge on the thing there.
So you could step on something and have a nail go completely through your foot, and you probably wouldn't know it.
The main thing was you'd ride in these 6x6 trucks, and you'd jump off the back, and you couldn't really feel when your feet hit the pavement. They were frozen.
And I understand that's still something that you're dealing with the effects of today at nearly 90 years old.
Yes, that's right. In fact, I used to ice skate. I got so that my feet would immediately go to sleep on the ice. So I didn't. And they still. Circulation not the best in them on the thing.
Well, just a reminder of what you and the men like you did so many years ago. Now, you talked about December 22nd and 23rd of 1944, and I imagine when Christmas came around, maybe that's a memorable Christmas for you. Is that a Christmas you reflect back on still today, that Christmas in 1944?
Yeah, there wasn't much joy there. We spent the Christmas preparing to go, we were preparing to attack the town of Grand Manil, and so when we did take it, we ended up standing in a foxhole at, you know, 12 below zero, because there was no shelter in the buildings. They'd already been hit by artillery, and there was no roof or windows on them, and there was just, and so the safest place was in a foxhole, because other than that, if you could find a building with a cellar, that was your protection, I think.
So how did you pass that time? Because it's got to be awfully lonely in a foxhole, and there's no warm Christmas dinner, and it's chattering teeth instead of Christmas carols that you're hearing.
That you have a one man, you have a two man foxhole. You have your, in my case, it was my assistant squad leader was with me there, and we'd have sea rations, but we couldn't have a fire, so we had a candle, and we'd light the candle and put the sea ration in a Mexican and try to heat them over the candle as best we could, and then of course one man has to be alert all the time, so you don't have a whole lot of conversation. That you try to get what sleep you can, and that's about the size of the thing there.
Is that a situation, not to put words in your mouth, but I'm just curious, is that a situation where you find yourself thinking about your wife and your family back home and wondering what they're doing for Christmas?
Oh, certainly, particularly on the holidays, John. You wonder what's the family doing and what are they eating and so on, and compares to what we were eating.
Something tells me it was a little better back home.
Yeah, right.
So now you talked about taking that city of Gramenil in Belgium, and this is part of that overall situation
right.
That's brewing called the Battle of the Bulge.
Right.
What was your role in that attack and that capture of that city, and what was the experience like for you?
It was something I'll never forget because as in most of those towns, they had a stone masonry wall around several of the places, and there was about a 6-foot wall around this place. We were on the outside, and the platoon commander said, "Stephenson, take your squad through there and take that building." And with your heart in your mouth, they opened the gate, and I charged through. And fortunately, I didn't know what to expect. I fired a few rounds at a porthole up there, thinking there might be a sniper in there. We went ahead and took the building and took the rest of the town that day. So
you're the first guy through the gate.
I'm the first guy through. I led my squad. Yes, I threw the gate.
And for those listening at home, how many in a squad?
12 in a squad.
So you've got 12 guys.
Yeah.
And it's you against you don't know who.
That's right. They don't know who.
I imagine that's one of those situations. A lot of times I ask a guy, what were you thinking? I imagine that's a situation where you're not thinking.
You're not thinking. You think just, is there an enemy looking at you, or is he going to shoot at you, or you shoot first in the thing?
But it all worked out.
It worked out fine, yes.
Was that was a sense of accomplishment for you
when
you got through
with that? Well, a sense of relief because a good friend of mine had the second squad, and he took his squad around the left side, and he got hit by machine gun fire and was crippled for the rest of his life and thing. And I went around the other side and didn't get hit. And what you call providence or God's protection.
Amen to that. Now, speaking of, I was curious. A lot of guys talk about carrying a picture of their wife or a little trinket or the Bible in their pocket, this and that they look back at and say, that's a sign of God being with me or luck on my side.
Yeah.
Did you have any kind of superstitions or any routine that you followed?
No, I think, we weren't allowed to carry, and for our own protection, any pictures or anything. We didn't even, all you had was identification.
Mm-hmm.
And we all had the little Bible that they used to do. Although at that time, I wasn't really what you call a devout friend, but I did believe in God. I had Sunday school teaching and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing you're really concerned with when you're a squad leader, you have 12 men that you're concerned with, and you have to sort of look out for them too, as well as looking out for yourself.
You know, I'm reminded as you say that back then, you, in your words, you weren't as devout as you are today.
That's right.
You've heard that saying so many times, there are no atheists in foxholes.
That's very true. That's right.
Was that something that was at work and it was formative in your faith to go through those experiences?
Well, certainly at the, when you're in a foxhole and artillery falling, you call on your maker, all right. No question about that.
So you talked about going into that situation in Gramenil and wondering where the sniper fire might come from. When you say that, it makes me think that at some point you probably did encounter some sniper fire.
Yes, I did.
And
yes.
Maybe even some close calls
close
in that
calls.
Regard?
Yes, we did. We were in the town of Saint Chateau, which had several high church steeples, and we were bothered by sniper fire most of the time. So if you walked by a doorway, which I happened to do, he sought me in. They breezed one past the bridge of my nose. That was as close as I'd ever gotten the thing there.
But so you probably, it's so fast, you probably can't see it, but you felt it.
You felt it, yeah. You felt it, yeah. And you couldn't hear the report. You didn't know where it was coming from, but you felt it all right.
What do you do in that situation? Do you stop for a moment and pause and take stock?
You hit the ground. The first thing, you hit the ground, and remind you not to go past that doorway again, the thing, and to keep your men away from that doorway. And the thing.
Now, earlier you talked about, you know, the Germans firing at you from an American tank they had captured. Yeah, yeah. Now they're shooting at you from church steeples.
That's right.
I guess it kind of makes it very clear that there may be quote-unquote rules of war, but they certainly weren't being followed where you were.
Oh, no. That the ambush thing, of course, was one of the things that's done in the war. I'm sure Americans did it too, but no, there were no rules. You try to be humane as you could, but that one, many places you couldn't apply that either.
Now, in this entire time you're talking about, it's still bitterly cold there in Europe. You talked about the frozen feet and how hard it was to know what was going on. You're jumping off the side of a tank and all those situations. At some point, did you get used to the cold? Did it become more routine and less just unbearable?
Yeah, I think it came through that all the difficulties you have, you learn to your rifle at night, you put it inside your sleeping bag and your canteen inside your sleeping bag, because if you don't, the canteen would freeze solid and you wouldn't have any water to drink in the morning. And also, your rifle wouldn't be operative if it was left outside and the thing. So you accept it after a while and the thing.
Did you feel like the fact that you all and all these infantrymen who are with you, that you all grew closer together because you were all experiencing this great catastrophic situation together?
Yes, particularly, it seemed like the veterans of the group, we had casualty, but as they were replaced by replacements, it seemed like the replacements, you didn't get to know them, and they were usually the first ones to get hit again, either from lack of training or something. But the old-timers, that we called them, we stuck together and had certainly a good affinity for one another. On the thing.
How did you deal with it when one of those old-timers or somebody that you had served with for a while did not come back from a mission?
Well, you can't have the standard bereavement. You just there's so many things happening, and the first morning after I lost some people, my duty as a squad leader, and I went around and I took his personal belongings and turned them into the first sergeant so they'd be sent to his people, and took his rifle and bayonet and stuck it in the ground, put his helmet on it for the Graves Registration people. But as a squad leader, I had enough duties that I couldn't sit and ponder things. I was always wondering about their well-being and my own well-being also on the thing. Yeah.
Maybe that was a blessing in disguise.
I think so, probably, yes. Yeah.
Kept your mind occupied. Well, we're at that point where we need to take another brief break. But when we come back, we'll talk more with Art Stephenson, 89 years old and a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge. We'll talk more about his experiences there and throughout the rest of the war and what he's been up to since then. You're listening to Hometown Heroes this afternoon right here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Long ago and far away, I dreamed a dream one day, and now that dream is here beside me. Long the skies were overcast, but now the clouds have passed. You're here.
Long ago and far away, that's what we talk about every week on this program. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. That was Joe Stafford singing Way Back When, a very familiar melody to our guest today, Art Stephenson, who is a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge, which 65 years ago today was nearing its end. That battle lasted from December 16th of 1944 to January 25th of 1945. If you go online, in fact, I'll have some links up for you at our website, kmjnow.com. look at some pictures of what it was like for these American soldiers, like Art in the 75th Infantry Division or any other units that were committed to the Battle of the Bulge, where more than 19,000 Americans were killed. Over 800,000 men committed to that battle for the Allied forces, and a very key moment in the eventual Allied victory in World War II. We were talking to Art about his time at the Battle of the Bulge, the cold conditions, the close calls he had, the proud moments he had as a squad leader. And when I look back in the history books, Art, it says it ended on January 25th, 1945. Did you guys know that it was over? Did you have any kind of signal that this intense situation was going to wind down a little bit?
No, because we were attacking or taking towns every day, and although we were headed then, more or less, we knew that we would be heading for the Rhine River eventually. Mm-hmm. The only thing we didn't know was that that the Germans would not put up a defense on the one side, that they would wait to put up a defense on the other side, which was proved to our advantage, and of course we had to cross the Rhine and then go on from there on the thing there. So.
When that Battle of the Bulge died down, and you just said there wasn't a key distinction because it was kind of one day of combat to the next for you.
Right, yeah.
Did you have any kind of idea, though, at the time, how in the big picture significant what you and all those other Americans did at the Battle of the Bulge was going to become?
Well, on a frontline company, you don't get a lot of news, but we realized, of course, that as the Germans started to retreat, that things were lessening up. But then, as the diverse thing, our division was sent down to the Colmar Pocket to fight with the Free French Army to relieve the town of Colmar, and we had some casualties down there, and then came back up into the action from southern France here and the thing.
Now, a lot of times on this program, I don't find out until after I'm done interviewing a veteran about the decorations that he received in the war. So I try to make it a habit now, before we even get on the program, of asking about any decorations someone might have. So I know that Art was awarded the Bronze Star during his time in the infantry. He also has that combat infantry badge that so many infantrymen looked forward to receiving. Can you tell me, Art, anything about why you are the possessor of the Bronze Star Medal?
I don't really know. There was no presentation or formal thing. You see, at the time, there were several acts of bravery by various people, but unless there was an officer there to write it up as a witness, there was never any incident really recorded on the thing. So this Bronze Star was issued actually, I don't know when it was issued, but I didn't receive a notice till after the war, and it appeared on my discharge paper on thing. So it was a rather remote thing for me. I knew I had acquired 3 battle stars, mm-hmm. And then I knew I was proud of the fact that I did have the combat infantry badge, but the Bronze Star was rather remote and didn't really ever receive a formal presentation on the thing.
So they didn't even give you a citation with it that said,
no,
this is what it's for?
No. I understand you could write today to get one, but it's
not that important to you.
Not that important to me. No.
Maybe your kids and grandkids will get busy on that.
Okay.
Not to embarrass you, but just to be proud of what you did and find that out. Well, that is interesting, and you know, that's just reality. You think of it, in a war zone, you don't exactly have time to go around patting people on the back and having big ceremonies.
That's right. I think, sure.
Especially on the front lines of the infantry. Which you were involved with that 75th Infantry Division. Now, so this is January of 1945 when the Battle of the Bulge wraps up, but it's not until May of 1945 that the victory in Europe is secured.
Yeah, yes.
So we've got 3.5-4 months there to cover. Right. And I imagine you were pretty busy that whole stretch. Where did you guys head, and what kind of experiences did you have?
Well, we were up, they shifted us around. We went up into Holland and to at the city of Venlo and fought up there and then crossed the Maas River there, and that was our first entry into Germany, and went there for a while. But then we thought we were going back to a rest area. Instead, we were headed south, and we were called down to go to the Colmar Pocket to assist the French First Army in the relieving the Colmar Pocket, which we were down there about a month, and then returned to the battles of the Ruhr, the Battle of the Rhine, and then crossing of the Rhine, and so on. The thing there.
You talked about getting into onto German soil for the first time. Was that something that, that bore some significance for you and the guys you were with? Is that something you talked about and said, yeah, we're here?
That's right. It was bore some significance. Yet the officers reminded us that now you're going to German territory, but we don't want any looting. We don't want any killing of livestock, that sort of thing. So it was a sort of subdued thing for us.
And I guess that's something that you have to make clear
sure.
You want to make sure you're sending the right message.
Now,
I imagined, and you talked a little bit about your duties when someone was a casualty in your unit, what you had to do as the squad leader. Give us a taste, if you can, for over the rest of this stretch, how frequent that was. And did you ever wake up saying, this may be it for me, this may be my last day? Because at some point it has to get to you that the guys around you are dropping and you're still there.
It's a strange thing because one of the early casualty I had was a fellow rifleman, and he said, we were riding up into the attack, and he said, will you take care of my possessions and send it back? I said, well, I've got as good a chance to get killed as you are. And sure enough, he was killed that night, and I had to take care of his possession, that sort of thing. But there again, you can't really dwell on that thing. You just go day by day and hoping that you'll be alive at the end of the day and the thing there. Do your duties the best you can on the thing.
You know, not to backtrack too much chronologically here, but you talked about the close call you had with a sniper in Song Chateau. And another thing that you encountered was something that I don't think, as far as I know, the American soldiers were aware of when they went overseas, but the buzz bombs, the German technology that was supposed to be kept secret. The American government didn't want the Americans knowing that the Germans had this technology they didn't. Tell me about the first time you saw and heard one of those and how you reacted.
Well, the early one was the one that was powered by a gasoline engine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no really control of the range, except they would put so much fuel in it. And you would hear the thing coming, and when it started to go putt, 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 you knew it was running out of fuel. That's not the time to head for your foxhole because you knew it was coming down. And they packed a terrific amount of TNT or whatever they're using. It really jarred you up on the thing. Later on, they become more sophisticated with the V-2, which was rocket-propelled or whatever, Carol, and much more difficult to shoot down and with very little warning. You just heard the swoop of it, and when it hit, it also packed a terrific amount of explosive on the thing there. So.
Well, did you guys have any idea what these were when you first heard them coming in?
Not a bit. Same way with our first jet plane. We saw our first German jet plane. We were preparing to cross the Rhine, and here come this silent plane with a little stream of flame behind it, and all of a sudden started to strafe us. We knew there was something wrong with the things we hit, but that was our first encounter, first time we'd ever seen a jet plane. I think.
That would be the ME-262, of course, and I imagine at that time, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. Today, jet planes are ubiquitous, but back then it's got to seem like something out of Flash Gordon comics.
That's why it was very, very unusual, I think, yeah.
Does that do anything to your morale to see that the enemy has something that you don't have?
Well, there again, they weren't enough of them. We didn't encounter enough of them to have the problem. One of the problems was that when the front line is so fluid, we were strafed two times by our own aircraft. And that was one of the, you never knew, you thought you had friendly people up there, and all of a sudden, can't blame the pilot, I guess they couldn't tell the difference, but... then when you get strafed by 50 caliber bullets, you know you're really ducking something.
How close did any of those situations come to getting you?
Well, they'd come next to the they shot the what they call flashlight off my BAR man who was right next door to me there.
Mm-hmm.
But being down in the foxhole, you do have a certain amount of protection and from the trajectory of the thing there.
When you're sitting in that foxhole, and whether it's opposing artillery or it's planes strafing you or whatever, are you closing your eyes and praying, or are your eyes wide open?
Well, you're praying something, and you pull that little helmet down over your head, trying to make it as big as possible and get as low as possible on the ground there.
Kind of like a turtle.
A turtle, that's right, yeah.
Well, something worked because you're here talking to me about it. As 89 years old, Art Stephenson is our guest today. Tell you what, we're going to take our last break. When we come back, I'm going to ask Art about where he was on VE Day. I think you'll find it interesting where he was on VJ Day, believe it or not, and what he did a little bit after the war as well. And again, if you're interested in joining Art and other local veterans who are involved in the Veterans of the Battle of the Bulge organization, shoot me an email at paul@kmjnow.com or call me here at KMJ at 490-5800, and I'll put you in touch with them. We'll take our last break, then come down the home stretch of Hometown Heroes today. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A few minutes left today with Art Stephenson, who's going to turn 90 years old on October 19th. That's my birthday, too, but I've got a few years to catch up with Art on that. I'll remember to call you on October 19th, though, Art.
All right.
We'll have some fun with that. Maybe we could play some tennis that
day. Yeah, sure.
You'll be ready to go, I know. You've heard from Art about his experiences in the Battle of the Bulge, which 65 years ago today was still going on in Europe, in a freezing Europe at that point. You heard him talk about receiving the Bronze Star and all the things that he did with the 75th Infantry Division overseas. But a few months after you got out of the Bulge, Art, you ended up hearing that the war in Europe was over. And a lot of guys who served with you at the Battle of the Bulge, when they were told, "For you, the war is over," it was from the Germans who captured them. There are a lot of POWs taken.
That's right.
But you made it through. You survived as an infantryman without a major scratch. But where were you in May of 1945 when you heard this wonderful news that the war in Europe had come to an end?
Well, just proceed. We were still in Germany. We got ready to cross the Rhine-Rhone Canal, going, and they called me up to the headquarters and said that we're going to send you back to qualify for a commission as a second lieutenant. So I went back to Fontainebleau, France, and passed some tests in the in Napoleon's old cavalry school. And we were out on VE, so-called VE Day. We were out passing our marksmanship with the machine gun, and then a little later on, then I received in June a commission as second lieutenant.
Was that a major celebration where you were when you guys got that news, or not that big of a deal?
Not that big a deal, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the major dates in World War II history, VE Day, Victory Over Europe Day, May 8th, 1945. And a few months after that, a little more than 3 months to be exact, is what everyone knows as VJ Day, Victory Over Japan Day. And you found yourself in a very interesting spot. On VJ. Tell our listeners what that was.
We were coming. I had been selected to bring 40 men to Camp Beale, California. And we were on the ship coming into the New York Harbor on VJ Day, and all the buildings, the tall buildings, were spelled out, welcome home and the victory is won and that sort of thing. It was a great day. We finally knew that both wars were over then.
That almost sounds like a surreal situation, like that news is too good to be true.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And so many veterans have described to me sailing into New York Harbor after the war that one particular thing that they saw meant a lot to them. Did it mean anything to you when you saw Lady Liberty holding up that torch?
Well, we sailed. We came. It meant more going out, but coming in, it was dark, of course. We didn't know exactly where we were or anything until all these buildings lit up on welcoming us home with VJ Day and thing.
And then once you hit the continent, you told us what your duty was to take those guys to Camp Beale.
Yeah.
But did you get to at least make it back to California and go see your wife again?
I had phoned ahead to her, and she drove up to Camp Beale, and I was previously married, and I had a one-year old son, and we happened to be there on his first birthday. And so it was a great reunion for my wife and to see my son for the first time there, too.
You'd never seen him before?
Well, I saw him at birth.
Uh-huh.
And that was the thing.
Had you seen any pictures or anything to that
point? Well, yes, yes.
And obviously he's too young to remember 1 year old, but that's a pretty good first birthday present to meet your father. I imagine that's a day that those memories of that day probably never leave you.
Never leave, that's right. Yeah, never leave you.
But unfortunately for you, the Army wasn't done with you yet.
No, not yet.
How much longer did you have to wait, and what did they make you
do?
Well,
that was in August, and I was assigned to Camp Roberts as an instructor, and stayed there till December, and my feet were bothering me on account of having them frozen, and I applied for Christmas leave, and I was home at Christmas leave, and got a telegram after the leave was over to report to Camp Stoneman in Pittsburgh, California. Now that, well, good now, I'm going to be discharged, and I met the commanding officer, and he said, you're now a troop train commander. And so my hopes were really dashed, and instead of being discharged, I was putting a poor lieutenant in charge of a whole troop train. And you go out, and you have to get your own rations from the quartermaster, and you get a list of the people of 600 or 700 returnees from the Pacific, have your own cook mess tent in there. And then we ran troops, returning troops to Camp Fannin, Texas. And then I would take a private, regular commercial train home. And I would have 2 or 3 days at home. And then the next run would be out, and it would be either Camp Fannin or it would be Camp Shelby, Mississippi. And I did that until I finally got my discharge notice to report to Camp Beale for discharge and thing up there.
And I imagine in the last 60 years, you probably haven't taken too many train rides. You got your fill with the Army.
I got my fill with the Army on the train, yeah.
I'm curious, though. It occurs to me, obviously, before and when you had ridden on a troop train to be moved from one place to another, the war is going on, and guys are kind of anticipating what's going to happen. Yeah. Now the war's over. How was that morale and that atmosphere different on those troop trains after the war was over?
The troops, we were with the troops coming home from the Pacific, and they were, as far as the rules, they weren't too well disciplined. They were going to really raise Cain, I think. I had all my rations and supplies in the one car, and I had to make sure that I locked it up and posted a guard, because if you didn't, they were in there stealing whatever they could, pineapple and the rest of the things. And I was charged with those rations.
Well, yeah, I guess after what they'd been through, this was a picnic.
That's right, sure, yeah.
Now, you came back home, and you had already been trained as an accountant, so you went to work in that field after returning to the Valley. And about 25 years after the war, not quite that long, you got involved with the Veterans of the Battle of the Bulge organization.
Yes, right.
And you're still involved with that. What has that meant to you to interact with other men who experienced that incredible time in world history the same way you did?
It's a different from other people. Yeah, these people have been with us. They knew what we went through, and there again, when you lose one of them, it's like losing a member of the family. And unfortunately, we're losing them quite rapidly on the thing there. So it's been a great organization and great reminders and great ceremonies, that sort of thing, too.
Is it when you hear someone else, another veteran who was at the Battle of the Bulge, and maybe a different part of the Battle of the Bulge, but to hear them describe the same kinds of things that you experienced, does it make you feel any different about your own experience and say, you know what, I'm not just imagining this. That's really the way it was.
That's right. You wonder, the guy will say, well, gee, he certainly has a good memory to remember all that stuff. You know, and you wonder, well, I hope that I'm not embellishing all the things that I went through, but as I remember the thing. But you do remember the towns and the villages, you remember going into the attack, and those things will stay with you for a lifetime.
Well, it's clear that they've stayed with you, and we're out of time on the program today, Art, but thank you so much for serving our country, for continuing to be involved with the Veterans of the Battle of the Bulge. And maybe you'll get a few calls out of this program today with some new guys who want to join your group. Thanks so much, and look forward to that tennis match on your 90th birthday.
Okay.
All right. That's Art Stephenson, our guest today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.